1099 contractors have no idea that they can actually qualify. 100% forgivable, people.
DC, the ultimate podcast. I'm your host, Russell Price, and we're celebrating 45 years of publishing in the DMV. It's a journey, a long journey. Before we get started with our special guest, Kenny Barnes, on our newsmaker line, I want to thank our sponsor, Tori's Restaurant, 700 V Street Northwest. An establishment that's been selling and preparing soul food for over 35, 40 years. During the pandemic, you can order through Uber Eats or you can come by and get a, what would they call, a soul food breakfast or a soul food. He's doing wonderful things. On our newsmaker line, the one and only Kenny Barnes. Kenny Barnes, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, Russell, what's going on, man? First, I got to acknowledge you. I mean, I got to acknowledge you before me because you've been an institution in this city for as long as I can remember. And as long as I've been doing things, Russell Price was out there videoing and talking, and everybody knew you, man, your magazine, and just everybody knew about you. So I've got to acknowledge you first.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. But tell us about Kenny Barnes, about who you are, how you got started, what you do.
Well, right now, Russell, I'm retired. But I can say that I've done an awful lot in my lifetime. As a matter of fact, I'm in the process right now of writing a book. I have a book written about all the different things I've been involved in. I guess one of the first things I want to talk to you about, I was born right here in Washington, D.C. I grew up in the Trinidad section over in Northeast Washington. You know, they call that Dodge City. It's pretty rough then, and it got to be even rougher. And then I went to public schools in D.C. I went to Langley Junior High School. I went to McKinley High School. As a matter of fact, when I was young, segregation was still in D.C. And I lived on right off of Montella Avenue in Northeast. And there was a school on Montella Neal called Wheatley Elementary School. And I had to bypass that to go to Wilson on 6th and K. I was a black class, believe it or not. My class was the first black class to go to Wheatley Elementary. I was in the fifth grade. And then, of course, I've got married and had children. I got, to, you know, my son was murdered. I have a son. I have four daughters. And I got 14 grandchildren, right? And so anyway, I got out there and started doing things. I think one of the things that most of your listeners may not know is that with Go-Go music started back in the 1970s. And when most people think about Kenny Barnes, a lot of people know me from my work with gun violence. After my son was murdered, and I got involved in reducing gun violence, and I started an organization called Root, which stands for Reaching Out to Elvis Together. But I actually started with Mel Edwards, a former disc jockey on WOL Radio. He and I actually were the first promoters and the people that came up with the concept of go-go. This is back in the 1970s at the squad room in Palmer Park, Maryland. Well, Russell, we hired a band. At that time, the band was known as Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers. And if you remember back then, Russell, everything everybody did was what they were called cabaret. You would go to the Burgundy Room or Knights of Columbus or Panorama. They were all called cabarets. So Mel and I came up with an idea that we want to do something different every week. But we don't want to do a cabaret because everybody's doing that. And so the record by Smokey Robinson was real hot at that time. It was called Going to a Go-Go. So we said, let's call it the Friday Night Go-Go. And we started at 12 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. And if you got there for 11, it was $3. And after 12, it was $5. And we had two bands, so it would be Chuck Brown, and then we would have another cover band, another band. And at that time, there was no such thing as go-go music. We hired Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers because they were the best cover band. If you remember, Russell, they could play music and play a record by somebody. It would sound just as good as the artists that played it. And that's why we hired Chuck Brown. And thus, Chuck Brown had been working on this special sound for a number of years. He talked about it on that radio clip I sent you when I interviewed him, that he's been working on this special sound. So the combination of Mel Evans and I coming up with the Friday Night Go-Go, the combination of Chuck Brown working on this special sound that he created, and starting this Friday Night Go-Go, that gave the birth to go-go music in Washington, D.C.
Excellent, man. That is a bit of history that is powerful. Go-go has become this music of D.C. now. People respect
yes.
go-go, but by you
yes.
being on the front runner of go-go,
yes.
and you saw the vision to call yes. it go-go and to
yes.
make it into an institution where it is today. What was your take when you saw it grow? How was your feeling when you saw go-go take off like it did? What was your take off on that?
Well, it didn't really take off when we started it, Russell. When I said it didn't take off, when we did it out of the squad room, it was the in place in town at that time where everybody in town would come to the squad room. And the reason why we did it from 12 to 6, because we wanted to get two crowds. We wanted to get the early crowd, and then we wanted to get the crowd of people after they left all the clubs in town. They had some place to go. So that was initially our vision. And for the first few years, there was nobody but Chuck Brown. There was nobody but Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers doing go-go music for the first 7, 8, 9 years in the 70s. But the thing about it, Russell, and this is what bothers me right now, I think I talked to you about it. There's some people, first of all, they do not really want to recognize that's the true beginning of go-go. I don't know whether it's because I'm involved, you know, because certain people just hate on you because they want to hate on you. Well, I don't know. It's just, they just don't want that true history. There's people that don't want to mock. It's the music of the city. And the city, my goal is that the city should acknowledge itself. If it's going to make go-go its music, it should acknowledge how it began and where it started and how it started. And it should give the proper credit to the people that were involved. Go-go just didn't fly out of the head, all of a sudden there's go-go music and people playing go-go music. It didn't happen that way. But anyway, for about the first decade, from the 70s to the, let's say, the 80s, it was Chuck Brown. And then in the mid to late 70s, along came Trouble Funk, or Trouble. And to give Trouble credit, Chuck Brown created go-go music, but the first actual band that was strictly a go-go band was Trouble. And then Trouble came along, and then after that, the Revision came along, maybe in the early 80s, when Rascals began. And so when Rascals began, and they became real popular, then that's when all the other go-go bands started springing up out of, from everywhere.
Right, because a lot of go-go bands came out of the woodwork. You had Backyard and Junkyard, and all these people kept doing go-go music. But what's so important today is the fact that you were originated. We want to ring the bell. You was the originator. And what you're
correct.
Talking about, people hating on you or don't like to give you the cred of actually starting it, I don't understand why they would not do that when you have the history and you're still alive. You can talk about it. Now, what's the rumor? The rumor that I heard, or allegedly I heard, that it was Mr. C that started go-go music. What's your take on that?
You mean Carl Henson?
Carl Henson,
Carl Mr. Henson?
C. They say he gave the first
go-go.
No.
Mr. First of all, let me explain why I say Mr. C. God, this is, had absolutely nothing to do with gospel music at all. I mean, nothing whatsoever. Now, we can go into another statement about how we started promoting concerts. With Collins was involved when I was with DJ Productions, and you know, with the Bayola, Carl Henson was involved with that. But the reason why people say Mr. C is because Mel Edwards' nickname in Richmond was Mr. C.
Oh,
that was Mel
Edwards'
name.
That's history. That's really history.
So Mel Edwards' name was Mr. C. Now let me tell you some of the rumors that you may hear. One rumor that you may hear was Max Kidd. Some people, you know, some rumor, other people say Max Kidd. Again, if you remember, you know, I think you knew Max Kidd. You know, I knew Max Kidd. We were friends. Max Kidd was a record promoter. He had nothing to do with promoting Go-Go. He was a record promoter, and he knew Max Kidd knew everybody. Plus, Max, if you remember, Russell, did a movie. There was a Go-Go movie. I don't know if you remember that or not. That Max was involved with, it turned out to be a bust because everybody was mad about it. That's another story. You may hear that I heard this guy from the Young Senators on a radio show one time and saying, well, he was the one starting Go-Go, and then Chuck Brown with the Young Senators school started Go-Go, and then Chuck Brown plagiarized the music from the Young Senators. Again, the worst thing from the truth imaginable. The Young Senators, if you remember again, the Young Senators were like the top band back then. Between the battle between Young Senators and Chuck Brown, they were the top band. I'll give them credit for that. But the Young Senators never even played Go-Go music. As a matter of fact, the Young Senators became the road band for Eddie Kendricks. I'm sure you may remember that too, Russell. When Eddie Kendricks left the Temptations and went on his own, the Young Senators became the band for Eddie Kendricks. So they traveled with Eddie Kendricks. Let me see what else you might hear. Now, this is the craziest one. I'm talking to, can I mention a newspaper? Is that wrong? Can I mention a newspaper or go without the libelous? If I mention a newspaper's name that I talked to.
Well, Jimmy Dugan is still alive, you know. Jimmy Dugan still keeping the Young Senators alive, man. He's still keeping the Young Senators' name and play, you know.
I know Jimmy.
Jimmy Dugan is still around, man. He's doing well.
I know Jimmy. I know Jimmy. I know him. When he was with the Young Senators, I know him. But what I'm saying is that the Young Senators didn't have anything to do with go-go music. Jimmy Dugan had nothing to do with go-go music. That's what I'm saying. Jimmy Dugan had nothing to do with it. It was Chuck Brown. The music was Chuck Brown. The music was created by Chuck Brown. And anybody that would say that Chuck Brown plagiarized the music from somewhere is not telling you the truth. Okay?
Excellent. That's a great point, man. That's why we call this Pulling Your Eyelids Open. This is an
ultimate
podcast. It gives you straight talk. It's no chaser. It's, we know where the bodies are buried, and we have people you to give real deal, holy feel. You're talking from the heart, and you're talking from the experience because you were there. You were actually
there. I was there. And I was there, a well-known picture at the time. And another thing, I was talking to this newspaper. That's why I was asking, I won't mention the newspaper's name, but it's the biggest newspaper in the United States, probably. And so they wrote an article about go-go music, right? And so I talked to the reporter that wrote the article, and the reporter said, well, go-go music just evolved. It just came out of the clear blue sky, and it started in nightclubs all around D.C. And I talked to the reporter. I said, that's not true. That is so not true. There was no go-go music in nightclubs around D.C. until after Chuck Brown started with the Squadron. And that's another problem, too, that may be bothering people, Russell, is that they want to say that go-go music began in D.C. when actually it did not. It began in Palmer Park, Maryland. The Squadron is in Palmer Park, Maryland on Baller Road. And the Squadron is where the Sugar Ray Leonard gym is now. That was the old Squadron. So maybe some people may have a problem with that. But anyway, this newspaper.
You're absolutely correct, because I was a PG County police officer, and when Sugar Ray Leonard used to live there, and they had the squad room there, and then they turned it to the Sugar Ray Leonard's gym. And you're absolutely right. The Go-Go started in Palmer Park, Maryland, and that was a place people went out to go to do Go-Go and to do events. Was at the Squad Room. People don't remember that, but you're bringing that history to front because you couldn't play no Go-Go music in D.C. There was no venue for it in D.C.
There was no go-go music
in D.C.
Russell, there was no go-go music. There was no such thing as go-go music prior to the Squad Room. There was no such thing as go-go music prior to the Squad Room. Go-go
real history.
Right. There was no such thing as go-go music. Now, I want you to think back, Russell. Remember the Burgundy Room? We used to go out there every week, or we would go to the Panorama Room, or we would go to the Knights Columbus, and Chuck Brown would be playing, or the Youngsters would be playing. They played the popular music of the day. There was no such thing as go-go music. When Chuck Brown came to the Squad Room, and Chuck Brown, if you remember, when he used to play that cover song, he would go into a ad-lib at the cabaret, and he was just going to an ad-lib. It's a Northeast Coon House, and I used to go ad lib. And what he had there at those cabarets was actually the beginning of what turned out to be go-go music. He brought that concept to the Friday Night Go-Go, and that gave a name to the music that Chuck Brown had been working on for years before. It, the name became go-go music because it didn't have a name. Now, so I remind you, you were there. There was no such thing as go-go music before the Squad Room in 1971. There was no such thing.
Excellent, man. Excellent. Well, I tell you, you're a wealth of history. And when Chuck Brown kept honing on his craft and creating the concept of go-go music, it got bigger and bigger and bigger, to the point where he became the name and the face to go-go music. Were you still involved with Chuck Brown at that point?
Well, let me tell you, Chuck Brown, you know, I've known Chuck for as long as I've known you, Father Russell. I've known Chuck for 45, 50 years at least, until his sad passing. In the radio clip I sent you, when he and I talking, was one of the last live radio broadcasts that he did. I don't know if you remember, I used to be a broadcaster on WPFW radio. I don't know if you remember that or not. And
I remember
had a show
that,
called
Spirit and Action. Along with the
Bama. Yeah, I had a show called Spirit and Action. Spirit and Action on WPFW. But anyway, when we talked about that and about Chuck had like a roller coaster career. When I say that, I mean, when he started off in the 70s, when there's nobody but him, right, it kind of petered out. When he got into the late 70s, Chuck kind of petered out a little bit when wrestlers came into play and all, and people started thinking Chuck was old. Go, here come these young teenagers now thinking old, right? So he kind of petered out a little bit, and wrestlers took over, and Trouble Funk and all those guys started coming out. And I'll tell you something else, too. Listen, about EU, right? Most people don't gonna realize that EU was not a go-go band either in the 70s. EU, the name of EU was called Experience Unlimited. And they were a band that played music like Jimi Hendrix. They worshipped Jimi Hendrix. So they called themselves Experience Unlimited. After the 80s, they changed the name to EU and then became a go-go band, but that was after the 80s. Most people don't realize that either.
And then
Chuck made a resurgence after the 80s. In the mid-80s, Chuck came back and made a resurgence. He got a new management team. What's Tom's last name? Gogoldorf or something like that. He got a manager, and the next thing, Chuck took off, and he never looked back. So, you know, he went up, he went and rose, he went down a little, came back up and stayed on top. And then he finally became recognized as the godfather of Go-Go. But I'll tell you this.
Well, what made the young people gravitate to Chuck Brown by him being old? What made the young people gravitate to him when they had Rare Essence and they had these young Go-Go bands? What made the young people start listening to his music and made him the godfather Go-Go when he was old.
Ah, because he was the original. When Chuck Brown performed, you've seen him. I've been to shows when Chuck Brown performed. I remember Darryl Brooks. Darryl Brooks had a concert out of Meriwether Books for me. And then Eric Badu and Raphael Sadiq, I think his name. And Chuck Brown came on right before them. Now, you got to realize this is like maybe six, seven years ago. Chuck Brown came out, and he absolutely rocked the whole Meriwether Books for me. And I was backstage, and Raphael Sadiq and Eric Badu said, "Why in the world did you put him on before us?" Right? Because Chuck Brown would rock that out. No matter how old he got, he was only one. There was one and only one Chuck Brown. That's why. Mm-hmm. And then he took on a little bit.
He was old, and young teenagers loved Chuck.
Loved him.
Wind me up, Chuck.
Yeah,
wind me up, Chuck. Wind me up, Chuck. And I mean, and these are young kids, but they love Chuck Brown.
And he was 60 years old. And then he brought in, remember he brought in Benny, God rest his soul to him. He brought in Little Benny. Little Benny had a go-go band called Little Benny and the Masters. And then he brought in Little Benny, and he had White Boy performing with him sometime from Rasmus. And then he had Sugar Bear from EU performing with him sometime. And so, but he was always rocked that house, man. And so the kids loved him. Yeah, they began to love him. And then he became, it's like he became an icon. Russell, I mean, as he got older, he became like an icon. And yes, the kid loved him as he came back.
Wow. It's amazing what go-go, the history of go-go. Now, tell us a little bit about some of the hiccups in your life that really you got over. When your son got murdered, what was that? I mean, you can't begin to, no one can begin to tell you what that felt like. But what happened with that situation? I mean, how did your son get murdered?
Okay. Before I go into that, let me just tell you, your listeners, one more thing, too. A little piece of trivia as well. Mel Edwards and I, along with DJ Productions, which I don't know if you remember DJ Productions in that, Russell, but Mel Edwards and I who produced the first black concert in the Kennedy Center. The first black concert. When I say black, I don't mean where black people performed because they had offers and stuff. I mean, we were the first black outside promoters to put a black show in the Kennedy Center. And it was called The Musical World of Quincy Jones with the Brothers Johnson. And then we did another show and followed the second black show in the Kennedy Center. And we followed that up with Del Phonics. I don't know if you remember when the Del Phonics was out of Pancakes.
Well, I'm from Philadelphia, man. I'm from Philadelphia. The Del Phonics was
so
big
in
Philadelphia, and that's where they became popular
about.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. So anyway,
right.
So we had the Del Phonics on Del Phonics and Stylus, and that Philly sound we added at the Kennedy Center. All right, so we did that. And then we also... We formed a guy with Mel Edwards and the WR Disc Jockeys, and we formed this entity called DJ Productions. And what we did was we started promoting concerts. And I'm sure you remember this concert as well. We did a concert at the Coldfield House in Maryland on a Christmas Eve, and it was snowing. So when I joined out, we had the Palmer Funkadelic, Bootsy Rubber Man, Natalie Cole, the Brothers Johnson, Hamilton Bohannon. I don't know if you remember that back at the Coldfield House, because I know you were around there.
How did you get those type of acts? Wasn't that controlled by Dimension Unlimited and big people? How was you able to get a main act like that?
Okay. That's a good question, too, Russell. Let me tell you what happened. When we started promoting concerts, at the same time, another guy that you know very well was starting to promote concerts at the same time. His name was Dimensions Unlimited. And
Dimensions Unlimited,
Bill,
right.
Bill, 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 uh, what's, was Bill's last name? What
was
the name?
I think it was Bill Reed. I think his last was Bill Reed.
No,
but I remember Bill.
No, not Bill. Bill, yeah, Bill and Dimension Unlimited were just starting to more conscious back then. But what most people did not know is that Bill Washington, that's his name, Bill Washington. Bill Washington and Dimension Unlimited, there was a big white promoter. Because back in those days, you know, black guy, you couldn't promote white acts. They would not allow you to promote white acts, you know. But anyway, there was a big white promoter by the name of Jack Wall, and he owned a club in Georgetown called Salador Productions. And so he was like the biggest white promoter in the area. But he needed a arm for his black entertainers. So he got Bill Washington. As I mentioned, Bill got his company called Dimensions Unlimited, and they became the black arm for Salador Productions and Jack Ward. So now in the meantime, Kenny Barnes, Mel Evers, and the DJs that have been all of us are friends, the DJs at WR Radio, and if you remember back in those days, Russell, WR Radio, the disc jockeys were like superstars. I mean, everybody
right.
With Bobby Bennett, Carol Hinton, Raymond St. James, Chuck McCool, Mel Evers, they were like superstars when they were. And so when we saw Mel and I did the Friday Night Coco, and we did a thing with the Moments at the little gym up, it was sold out on 13 and G. And so now we said, well, maybe we could promote concerts. So we got together and put this entity together, which was my idea. God, it was called DJ Productions. And what we did, the reason how we were able to get these acts was that we had one advantage over Jack Ball and Bill Watson, and that WL was one of the hottest radio stations in the country back at that time. And so we could play your music. We could play your music. Right? So we could play, not only could we play your music, but if we promoted you, we would give you the same amount of money that you and Bill Washington would give you. And plus, you know me, I got a good, pretty good personality, so I was able to get along with all the entertainers and all. And so we would talk directly with the entertainers. So we didn't go through no publishing company, no management company, or we didn't go through a manager. The only way we talked to a manager was that the entertainer told me to talk to the manager and just work out the details. Other than that, we talked directly to the entertainers. You know, I talked directly to Natalie Cole. I talked directly with George Clinton and his management team. Or I talked directly with Boosie Collins. Or I talked directly with the Commodores. You know, we talked directly with them. And so that's how we were able to get around going through other people. And now,
but how were you able to get their phone numbers? How were you able to get their contact? How were you able to get their phone numbers to do that and to go around the manager? And how'd you get by the white man that's over there in Stella Door? How did he let you do that? That's what I'm saying. Today you have Live Nation. A promoter can't do that today. You can't go get Beyonce today. You can't do that today.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then, you got to remember back then, this is early on when entertainment was just coming to Washington. I mean, the big time stuff was just breaking out. It was just coming to us. Okay? And so how do we get... Because WR Radio, number one, was one of the top radio stations in the United States of America back in those days. Mel Lewis and Bobby Bennett and these guys like superstars. And I'm with them. And I like work with them and I represent them. So we were around these entertainers. And so all I would do was talk to see Natalie Cole perform. I'm talking about see Natalie Cole. Well, oh, you got called her. Hey. This is that just Kenny Barnes, but you know, I want to W on this shot. And this is what we want to do. And then they would always give me their number. They would always give Bobby Bennett their number. Because you got to remember, they're coming in, the record promoters are coming in and doing the ad buys for these artists to play their records. And so when I talked to them, I said, this is what we do. And then we got it further, Russell. What we did was, not only did we lock up Washington, you know, Washington, D.C. is a major breakout area as far as selling records is concerned. For some reason or other, and you know this yourself from your experience, an artist can't make it in Washington, and an artist actually has to leave Washington to become successful. But it's a major breakout area. I mean, you can sell a million copies in from Baltimore to Norfolk. And so I said, wait a minute, we can expand this. And so what I did was, we got involved with the disc jockeys in Baltimore. You remember the Moon Man? The Moon Man.
Just talk to Moon Man. Is still on the radio today. 80-something years old.
I didn't know
still
that.
Music.
I didn't know that.
Still got his shows and everything, man. Got his radio shows on the internet. Still rolling.
That's my man, Willie Baycoat. That's his real name. But the Moon Man,
Willie
that's my
Baycoat, man.
You got
real history. Yeah. I'm going to give him the. I'm going to make sure he gets your interview because he's still active. He's still active in the music business. He has his radio shows on the internet now, and we gave him an Oscar maybe 2 years ago. We gave him honored him at the Living Legacy Awards. But you talking about things that people don't know or they forgot.
No, they don't have a clue.
Now you're bringing it back
don't have a clue.
No,
they don't
you
have.
Got, you know
no.
everything. Did you
no.
remember? Do you remember the concert when they had the DJ Take It Easy Ranch? Remember that concert?
I remember it very well. When Nighthawk
they said that DJ got
well.
He was missing. They couldn't find with the Nighthawk. They couldn't find whatever
That's
happened
right.
to the Nighthawk. They don't know what happened to him.
Well, some people know. Some people know what happened to him. Some people know what happened to him. Right,
but that was a big 3-day event. To take it, they
right.
could not do something like that today, could they? Could they,
no,
Jenny?
No,
you couldn't do a
no,
Take It Easy
no,
Ranch.
No. And what happened at the Take It Easy Ranch, I was not involved with Nighthawk. I didn't get involved with the WO disc jockeys. Until after Nighthawk disappeared, and then Bobby Bennett took Nighthawk's place, and so I had nothing to do with Nighthawk. I knew it, but I do know that Nighthawk got involved with some missing money or something from what the rumor was, and that he just disappeared, and nobody's ever heard from him. Don't know where nobody ever heard from him again. There was another. If you remember too. There was another W.O. disc jockey that we were and I was involved with, that he was a part of us briefly until he was murdered. You remember Soul Papa, the Bebop?
Soul Papa, yes,
Soul
Papa. He was
Soul
Papa,
the Bebop.
You got the history, Kenny. You know
yeah.
all the clues,
yeah.
man. You check all the boxes.
Yeah.
I was with WL for over 20 years. I had a late night talk show with WL for over 20 years. And I was with the Radio 1, and it was called Al Mac back then. It wasn't even called Radio 1. It was called Al Mike or whatever. It was it was named after the Suns. It wasn't even Radio 1 back then.
Wait a minute. Let's go back into the history to clear the record as well. WOL Radio, let me finish the story about the disc jockeys first. And so what we did was we got in contact with all the disc jockeys from Baltimore down to Hampton, Norfolk area. So we controlled the airways from Baltimore to the Hampton, Norfolk area. So if an artist, wanted to work with us and wanted to get his record played, we could get it done from Baltimore to Hampton. So you see why we could talk to the artist because we were a very powerful entity. So what happened was, we got all of these artists lined up. We got them all. I mean, you name them, we had them. Apollo, Funkadelic, Bootsy Rubber Band. We were in contract negotiations with the OJs, Natalie Cole, Brass Constructed. We did a concert with Richard Pryor, North Wind and Fire, in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, we just had everybody lined up. So what Bill Washington and Jack Boyle realized, wait a minute. You see what's going on here. These guys, but it's Kenny Barnes. It's Kenny Barnes that's running this shit, right? And so all we need to do is take this power away. And so what Jack Ball and Bill Washington did, they filed a lawsuit against the WL disc jockeys and the WL radio with the FCC for payola and plugola, right? Now, there was no payola involved, right? That payola is when somebody's giving you money to do something. There was none of that involved. But plug holing, I'm sure you know what plug holing is. Plug holing is that when you have a concert, play whoever the concert, whoever the artist is, you play his music even before or after the advertisement. That's considered as plug holing. Well, everybody does that, and that's still being done today. So that wasn't no big deal. But what it did was, Russell, was it destroyed the reputation of WOL Radio. And, of course, it broke up. No artists wanted to work with us after that. And so we lost all the artists. And then guess who picked up the artists that we were working with? Russell, a guy accompanied by the name of Celador Productions.
Mm-hmm.
Don Brooks. Gregory Hines was working with me and working with us. When DJ Productions broke up, Gregory Hines was like working very closely together. Gregory took all the artists that we had been working with, carried them to Don Brooks and Carl Kirkendall, and they were called Tiger Fire Productions back then. And they began promoting concerts. And I tell you another outcome of the that most people don't know about. Another outcome of this DJ Production scandal. The corporation that owned WOL Radio was called Sonderling. It was called the Sonderling Corporation. They decided to sell WOL Radio. Well, guess who they sold it to?
Who?
Guess who? Dewey Hughes and Gabby Hughes. That's what Cat Hughes first got us started. The first radio station was a WOL radio. Dewey Hughes, if you work at WOL, you remember Dewey Hughes. He used to work at WOL.
Oh, yeah.
He's still alive, too. Yeah, he's out in California. Yeah. And so Dewey Hughes and Cat Hughes. Oh, he's back here now.
Yeah, he's been back here for a while. I thought before the pandemic he was here. I don't know where he's at now, but he was definitely before the pandemic he was here.
Well, Dewey Hughes and Kathy Hughes bought WOL Radio. In their divorce proceedings, when they got divorced, Dewey Hughes, as part of the divorce proceedings, gave Kathy Hughes WOL Radio. And so Kathy Hughes got her start. WOL Radio used to be on the corner right over Russell, if you remember, on 4th and 8th Street Northeast. I don't know if you remember, she'd be right there, they'd be right there in the window.
I was there, man. I was there for 15, 20 years in that window. I did a late night talk. In that window.
So you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about, right? I'm familiar.
So Kathy Hughes, as a direct result of that payola scandal, Sonderly Corporation stole WOL Radio. Kathy Hughes became the beneficiary. And now Kathy Hughes is the biggest more TV, radio, mobile in the United States of America, or one of them. Okay.
No question. That's wonderful lady. Wonderful, powerful, and humble lady.
Very powerful. Very nice, decent. Yes. And if you remember her, when I first met her, she was at WHR. Her name was Kathy Lickens. If you remember, she was at WHR. And she was an account executive, and she became the general manager of WHUR. So that's how far back I know her from back then.
You got the real clues. You got all the boxes, Kenny. You know the history of DC, the go-go, the radio.
Yeah.
You know it all.
Yeah.
You have the true essence of this town. And that's why I'm so happy to have you on this ultimate podcast, Pulling Your Eyelids Open, because today you pulled some serious eyelids open. Where do you see music today? Tell us about why music is the way it is today and how come DJs don't have that kind of clout anymore. Why is there no popular DJs? Why is music in a different way of being presented today? What changed it all, Kenny? What changed it all?
I'll tell you what happened. If you remember when we talked earlier, we said how the WOL disc jockeys were like superstars. So the stations promoted the disc jockeys. And so the disc jockeys were like, whenever they went out, they were like superstars. Well, once we took advantage of that, when I say we, I'm talking about DJ Productions and the concerts, and we took advantage of that superstardom, the stations made a decision. You know what? We're not doing that anymore. We don't promote this. We don't promote this basis now. We're not promoting disc jockeys anymore. So much so that I can't even tell you who's on the radio now. You know, back then, if you asked who's on the radio, well, you know, Bobby and Benno was on 3 to 7, and Charlie and so was on in the evening, and Chuck McCool was on in the afternoon, and Raymond St. James was on in the weekend, and I mean, on in the mornings, and Mel Edwards on the weekends, and Greg Hines on weekend. I mean, you can rattle off just like that. Right now, you don't know who's on radio.
You have no idea who's on the radio, right? There's no such thing as the body. Who's playing the music? You don't know who's playing the music. Name is not household names anymore.
They're promoting. With that payola scandal, the radio stations realized we made monsters by making these disc jockeys so big. We're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to make the disc jockeys big anymore. We're going to promote our radio stations from now on. And so that's what changed that. Okay. And so now, if you want to talk about like my how I got involved, you know, with this, with my son and my son's murder, I'll go into that for you if you like.
Yeah, we want to talk about some of you. We want to switch gears and talk about some of the hiccups that you had. You overcame some serious things in your life. I mean, the murder of your son. Are you going blind? I mean, this thing about you being blind. How many years have you been blind now?
Let's see, I started about 10 years ago. I started slowly going blind about 10, 12 years ago. I started.
So when you first, the first inkling you saw was, what, you couldn't see something, it became blurry? How did it slowly evolve to blind?
Right, well, it became blurry, and I went to a doctor, and I think a real doctor messed me up, one doctor didn't mess me up. And so what happened was I had this laser surgery on my right eye. And the doctor did something wrong. And so I was seeing my right eye one day, and all of a sudden, my right eye couldn't see out of it all. After that, I tried this too, but it didn't work out. And then my left eye was my
reason. Why couldn't you sue? Why didn't it work? Well, if he did something with the laser surgery and he blinded you, why couldn't you win that suit?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. You know, I got a lawyer. Lawyer got involved. Gave the lawyer a retainer. The lawyer came back and said to me, well, you know, I don't see how I can proceed. And so he said, you can get somebody else if you want. So I just said, well, if he's a lawyer and he can't do it, we're just getting somebody else. Doctor may have paid him off. I don't know. They may have paid him off.
Your other eye started going blind.
Well, what happened was my right eye was my strongest. You know, you may have a stronger eye and a weaker eye. So my right eye was my strongest eye. My left eye was my weakest eye. And so what happened after that was my left eye, because that's the only eye I could see out of, was starting to slowly but surely degenerate. And it was just slowly getting worse and worse. And they told me there was nothing they could do about it because of the surgical procedures that had been done were done in my lenses. My tubes are being the tubes connecting the eye to the brain. Well, there's so much scar tissue back there that there's nothing they can do about it, and they can't operate because that's connected to the brain. And so my left eye started getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and it just progressed over like a 10 or 12 year period. So right now I'm like 98% blind. I still see shadows in my left eye. But that's about it. I can't see people. I can't see objects. Right.
Well, how did you become so strong, though, Kenny? I mean, how would you – look at you talking to me today, this podcast, the knowledge that you have, your strong attitude and your positive outlook, and you still are contributing and being somebody. How did you convert that to being so – I think that would have killed me. I would have been some kind of – depressed mode or something. What made you be strong like you are today?
Well, a couple of things. As black men, if you grew up in inner city, if you like I did, if you grew up in inner city, if you came from a poor family, you know, automatically you're kind of used to adversity. You know, just by growing up in poverty and segregation and racism and stuff, you're kind of used to adversity. But I think when my son got murdered, I think that there's nothing worse that can happen to a human being than to have the child murdered or the child taken from them. And if you can survive that as a parent, then it's nothing you can't survive. And so what I did was I took the negative energy. I mean, I've always had a philosophy, Russell, that there's a positive to every negative. No matter what the negative act or situation may be, there's some kind of way you should be able to turn around and make a positive out of it. And that's my philosophy. And so I take my negativeness and I make a positive out of it. And then the third philosophy, you and I were talking about this the other day, is that you play blackjack, you play poker. If you play blackjack, you get a hand, you fold it, get another hand. But in life, you don't have a one hand. And so in life, you got to play the hand you dealt. And so what I do is I play the hand that I'm dealt, and I play it to the best of my ability. That's my philosophy.
I commend you without a doubt, man, because to do what you have done, when I saw you about maybe a year ago at the Social Security office. I didn't know you were blind. And you said, I'm blind.
We talked
like you were just not blind. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
I didn't realize it.
Your attitude. Now, tell us about how you got to be in a relationship. Now you're in a relationship now. How does a blind man get to be with a young woman in a relationship? How does that happen?
To explain that, Russell, you know me. You know me for years, and I don't know how to say this, but I never had a problem with women. I mean, that has never really been one of my problems. You remember what's his name, Jay-Z? I had 99 problems, but a big one.
Because you're now in a relationship with a woman who's like 20 years younger than you. And she's there for you. That's a blessing in disguise to have someone to be there for you.
Yeah.
And to love you and to make sure you're okay. People with both eyes don't have that. People who got 20/20 vision in their 70s don't have that. During the pandemic, there's more men running around with no woman, and you have a woman during the pandemic. I want to commend you on that also.
Let me be honest with you. I don't have a clue even what she looks like, but I can tell you what her body's like. You know what I mean?
You have never seen her, so you have never seen her face ever, because when you met her, you were totally blind, but you have never seen her face.
No.
Kenny, that's serious, man. That's serious love, but you know what her body feels. You know what she's like physically. But you have no idea what she looked like for real.
I can feel those curves, Russell.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I can feel those curves, serious.
You're a blessed man. You are truly a blessed man, Kenny. You are blessed beyond blessed because, I'm telling you, people are looking for a relationship, looking for someone to be in their life. I mean, and they have all the attributes. They got money, big cars, houses, all kind of stuff, but no woman. You know what I'm saying? Nobody loved them for real. So this lady here is quite apparent. She loves you. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
She loves you. So you were able to meet her and be involved with her, and then now she's with you, and you got somebody to be with you. You know, it's a blessing, especially during the pandemic.
Right.
It's a blessing. It's a real blessing to have a woman in your life. I mean, I just want to, again, a matter of fact, I'm going to ring the bell for you, man, because you doing it, brother. Did they ever find your son's murderer?
Yes. Okay, let me give you the story behind that, too. I didn't go to college right after I graduated from high school because I had a child. I got married in 1963. Had a child in 64 and another one in 65. And so I didn't go to college at first. And so I went out into the field and I'd done these things, you know, promoting, whatever, all that stuff. And then, so then I became a sales manager. It was for, it's Comcast Cable now. I don't know if you remember, but Comcast Cable in Prince George's County was called Multivision Cable.
I remember that.
Okay, I was a sales manager for Multivision Cable in Prince George's County. All right? It's now called Comcast Cable. And what happened was I got very, very, very ill. And I had to be placed on a respirator. They thought I was going to die. And so I was on a respirator for a month. And the doctors called my mother and had to ministers in there. They didn't think I was going to live. But as a matter of fact, I literally died for 2 minutes. I literally died. And for anybody who has any questions, I didn't see nothing. I didn't see no white lights. I didn't see Jesus. I saw nothing. I just died for 2 minutes, and they woke me and revived me. That's all I know. So anyway, so after that, after I recuperated, it took me about a year and a half to recuperate. I said, you know, I'm sitting around here now, relatively young man, 45, 50 years old, man, never been to college. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to college. And so I decided to go back to college, and I decided that I want to get a degree in psychology after doing a little research. Psychology is a field that most black people don't understand and don't want to be bothered and say that's white men's medicine. No. And I said, you know what, let me go to psychology, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the treatment methods that they use, which are basically, if you really know about psychology, it's a Western phenomenon, and the treatment methods are for white Western males. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to use that, but I'm going to make it relate to us, and maybe I can put some back in my community by helping people with a lot of mental illness, a lot of depression and, you know, stuff in our communities. You know, that's what I do. And so so I went to UDC. I got my bachelor's degree in psychology in 1997. And then I got my master's degree in clinical psychology from UDC in 1999. I then was accepted at Loyola College in Baltimore, which is a very white, rich, white, upscale college, university. I was the only black person in the program, and by far the oldest person in the program. And I went there. So as I'm going into my third year, working on my PhD, my doctorate, as I'm going into my third year, I got the news. I was on the way home one evening. And I remember this day distinctly because there was a tornado coming through Washington, D.C. It's the only time that I've ever known a tornado to come through D.C. And it was coming straight up, like Route 1. And I lived at that time in Laurel, Route 1. So I'm running away from this tornado. And as I get in the house, I get a call. I get a call from my sister first. And she tells me that my son has been shot. And I'm like, what? And that's a pretty interesting. The first thought is always a positive thought. Well, you know, he probably got shot in his leg or elbow or something. And he and I will be laughing about this one day. And then his wife called me and told me that he was murdered. And to get that news, Russell, think about the worst hurt that you've ever had in your life. Mm. And multiply it by about 10,000. And multiply it by about 10,000. And that's the hurt to that bill. And so when I went down, I had to go and, you know, go to the, he was at the emergency room up here at Howard University. And at that time, and you, Coach, you know my son, Russell. So at that time, he was in a clothing store on 11th and U Street Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it that made it so bad was my son was he was like a visionary. When he went down there in 1998, 1999, I asked him, was he out of his mind? Because U Street at that time was nothing but prostitutes and drug addicts and selling drugs and all that stuff. That's what was on U Street in 1998, 1999. He said,
right,
Dad,
he had the vision.
So
I went down there to see the store, man,
vision.
And I used to go to the store all the time, man. He had the vision to see that youth people was going to be upcoming.
Right, he had that vision, which I did not have. And so the only thing about it, he got killed before that vision actually came to fruition. So anyway, so when I went by, to the harbor, and of course, the thing about me, Russell, is that, how do I explain? I know the streets. I'm not a street person by any means, but I know the streets. People know me. I know people. I know everybody. You know, I know everybody in Washington. No man, no matter where you come from. I mean, you can come from off of 16th Street or Alabama Avenue. I know everybody in Washington. Most people, a lot of people know me. And when you're known and people know you in the street and they respect you, people know who killed somebody. They may not tell the police, but they know who did it. And so that night, when I was at the hospital, I got a phone call from somebody, and they told me who it was. I knew the night my son was murdered, who murdered him. I knew that same night. And and so what we eventually found out was that the young man that killed murdered my had murdered at least two other people during the course of a year. And so naturally, you know, I turned it, and a lot of people came to me, and they were like, I turned the name over to the police, and like the young man turned himself in within the next week, right? So they caught him, and he got sentenced to, he had three murders. He got sentenced to 33 years for each murder. He got sentenced to 99 years, and he got another 6 years for a gun charge. So he got, he was 17 years old. So he got sentenced to 105 years straight time. So he's still in jail at this time right now. Right. And so people told me
that's
at the time,
great.
I never forget.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad that they caught him. You know, that's when, you know, see, I'm from the old school where the death penalty fits. In his case, the death penalty fit. I mean, give him 199 years, that sounds good, but you got to live out them years where that death penalty, boy, you go on. You ain't never coming back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'll tell you something else, Russell, because I knew some other people, you know, and they would tell me, man, you can't snitch. Like, what are you talking about? I'm not a snitch. What are you talking about? I'm not involved with no drugs. I'm not selling no drugs. I'm selling on somebody that murdered my son. Whether you like it or you don't like it, I don't care. This person murdered my son.
No, you're not no snitch, man. This person took your son's life. I mean, these things today, even the way the police are killing boys and everybody's getting killed. When somebody takes a life, it's not a thing about a snitch. It's about the right thing to do. You know, you would have been, you had to do that. There's no way you could not do that. You knew who he was.
I had to know it. I knew
he
was. I had
to go kill him yourself.
You understand? You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And then on top of that,
you know,
this is
the least of your worries. I mean, you know, he's lucky you didn't go get your own gun and kill him, man. I mean, that's the way you get a father's love for a father. The love for a son is a powerful thing. And somebody takes your son's life, you know, I mean, that's just hard. It's hard.
Another thing, Russell, my son knew this kid. I mean, my son had tried to have to be a mentor, had tried to look out for this kid. We used to let him work at the store and pay him to clean up and sweep the front and all that. My son paid him. So he walks in my son's store one day. He walks in my son's store, 7 o'clock in the evening on September 24th. My son, if you went in the store, there was some steps right there. My son was sitting on the steps. The kid walked in there, sit on the steps. They were talking for about 20 minutes. Because there was a witness there. They talked for about 20 minutes. And then this kid just picked up, stood up, and pulled a gun out and said, well, okay, you know what time it is. Now, my son was on the phone. Now, he's not looking at this kid as any type of threat. And so he tells the kid, man, stop playing. Just take that gun out of my face. Stop playing. What the hell's wrong with you, buddy? And so the kid took and pulled a gun, shot him in his face. Killed him in his face.
Come on, it's crazy.
It's over there.
I tell you, Kenny, you've had a one life information and things you had done, but this has been not only has this been a wealth of information, it's been a eye-opening. We have lifted and pulled eyes open today. What I want you to do at this point, because we have really, really had a conversation, I want you to give us your closing statements.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for allowing us to talk, because a lot of things that you and I discussed about, these are not things that are not known in the general public. They're not things that are known in the general community. And so I want to thank you for that, number one. I want to make sure that you send me a link to this broadcast. I'd like to be able to save it and have it and put it on my Facebook page and all that. So I want to make sure you do that. And I want to let you and your listeners know that I'm still out here. I'm still trying to do things. I'm trying to get another thing I don't understand right quick. I'll leave this. Is that the mayor just formed a task force, I mean a department, to prevent gun violence. I am probably the most recognized expert in this city as far as gun violence and dealing with gun violence. On. I haven't even got a phone call, Russell. The president knows more about it than anything. I haven't even got a phone call. And so if any of you listen, know anybody, just spread the word or say something to the mayor, say I'm available for consulting. And I'm going to text this
show, this interview, to the mayor's office. I'm going to put it on our Facebook page. I'm going to make sure that she hears this actual podcast, pulling your eyelids open, and maybe she'll call you. But also, there's other people that's doing gun violence situations. I mean, I want to make sure they get a copy of it. I'm going to talk to people after this interview and let people know that we've had this one-on-one powerful interview, pulling your eyelids open with the one and only Kenny Barnes. So this is what we're going to do. So
one more thing I want to ask you, my friend, is I want to ask you to help me promote the fact that Coco started with me and Mel Edwards and Chuck Brown in the 1979 and 1980. And I want you to show that video where Chuck Brown and I are talking about how GoGo began. And I want you to help push that to your network and let people know.
Well, we're going to do a marketing campaign for you. We're going to do an actual marketing campaign, the magazine, the podcast, the video, everything. We're going to put together a documentary for you so people can – we'll talk about that. But again, I want to thank you. Kenny Barnes is a serious asset to the DMV, to the D.C. area, and you've heard it first right here on the number one ultimate podcast in the DMV, Pulling Your Eyelids Open. I'm the host, Russell Price. We're celebrating 45 years of publishing. Spread the word. It's going to be a big one.
Thanks, Russell.